Well, Chaplain Eva Bleekler. Oh God, Bleekler. I'm sorry.
Who's that?
Who's that? Chaplain Eva Bleeker. Welcome back to the Real Humans Podcast.
I'm glad to be back with you, Tristan.
Awesome. It's so good to be back, and we are back for part two, because the last time we ran out of time, but I'm coming back. I'm so happy that we get to just spend some time together for a little bit and just kind of conclude our conversation. And for those of you who are maybe catching the second episode, we have as our guest today, Dr. Eva Bleeker, Chaplain Eva. She's a board certified professional chaplain with a decade of experience in care hospitals and an assistant professor at Denver Seminary. And so it's so good to have her on.
Great to be with you. It's so fun to celebrate a long friendship with you, Tristan. It's just really special.
And I was actually thinking about I was thinking about just a little bit of our conversation in part one, and I was like this relationship has spanned almost 2 decades, and it's just wonderful just to have people like that in your life, who can look back on you and you can look back on them and just kind of see the progress in their lives from where you started, to where they are now. And so that's been pretty cool.
I agree.
So Chaplain Eva, the last time we were framing the conversation around kind of your view of what it means to be on the front lines of human care, and what that means in terms of suffering. And so I want to transition from that to your research areas, because I am super fascinated by your research areas. And so you've actually got several of them, right? So you've got the pastoral care, you've got narrative identity, and then you've got practical theology. Would you tell our audience what these things mean and what drew you to them?
I will. I would say for me, the things that hold my research interests together in the center is the way that they are organized around life stories. So the conversation that we had last time we were together about the way that suffering shapes human storytelling and the way that it can anchor our identity, those experiences in my own life, and then also seeing how that played out in the pastoral caregiving that I was doing in the hospital, started to bump me toward these research interests. So if I were to name my theoretical frameworks, you will notice that each one has narrative in the title.
That's
So
right.
my understanding of myself as a pastoral caregiver, I would say my theory of caregiving is narrative pastoral caregiving. And if you ask me, what grounds you when you're in the classroom with adult learners? Like when you have that moment when you realize you need to check in with yourself and say, what do you think you're actually doing when you're standing at the front of the classroom? Besides hopefully praying a little prayer, I would check how does what I'm doing with this student or these students right now fit with narrative transformative learning theory? So transformative learning theory is specific to adult learners, and it is so good at recognizing what it means when we ask adults to change their identity based on what they learn. So for me, this reaches really deep into church-based education. Our churches, are we thinking when we teach a Sunday school class that what I've lifted up out of the biblical text could create crisis for the person who came to my adult Sunday school class today? Or do we just think that we're going to use our intellect to reach Jesus Christ? So narrative identity theory is as old as narrative, excuse me, narrative transformative learning theory is as old as transformative learning theory itself is, but it recognizes how the processing of an adult's life story is necessary for real learning to take place. It is not simply an intellectual activity. Mm-hmm. That shift in identity is real big. And then my psychological framework, which let's start by saying that I am, unlike you, I am not a mental health professional. So you are the mental health professional in this dialogue, but the ways that I have moved through learning to be a chaplain, yes, require me to account in some way for what it means that we are meaning-making beings. And the psychological theory that I have found to be the most useful to me is called narrative identity theory. It was pioneered by an incredible scholar named Dan McAdams. I may have mentioned him in episode one. I can't remember, Tristan.
But I think you might have as well.
I think I might have. Mm-hmm. But his way of honoring the giving and receiving of life story, he and the scholars who research in narrative identity theory, has proven to me very useful in understanding what's happening in a lot of sort of dyadic caregiving settings. That what's happening when the chaplain is visiting somebody bedside in the hospital? What's happening when a pastor is meeting with a member of his or her congregation who's in distress? What's happening when a professor sits down with a student who is facing a significant challenge somehow related to, you know, I teach grad school. This idea that we are constantly revising, whether we realize it or not, that we are in this constant revision of meaning in this locus within the self, this narrative identity, has helped me, for one thing, make sense of my own internal mess. Mm-hmm. And also, it has really helped me trust the work of the Spirit of God when we are listening to a story that is a really hard story to hear. So I'll stop there, Tristan, and see where you want to take us. All those words that I just said.
So Eva, I feel like there's so many tentacles, mm-hmm, to what you were just speaking about. And the question that popped in my head as you were kind of just breaking down narrative theory and how it has impacted your ministry and your time in the classroom. I'm curious as to how have you seen it? So you talked about it, how it's transformed your life. Mm-hmm. How have you seen it transform the lives of the people that you work with in the hospital settings? And how have you seen it? How have you seen it working in the lives of the students that you've been able to impact?
Oh, there's so many powerful experiences that come to my mind. We'll start with the hospital since you pointed there first. What I learned on the job in the chaplaincy training program there at Baylor University Medical Center, I had such incredible trainers there. I just want to give a shout out to the Reverend Carlos Bell and Dr. Sadawe Soga and the Reverend Rebecca Adrian. They were the kind of teachers that I discovered that I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So in that setting of learning there, when I was training in the CPE program at Baylor, what I found is that chaplaincy is this deeply narrative endeavor, to the extent that I have a colleague named Rhonda Cooper, who published a lovely article in which she calls chaplains the story catchers. Mm-hmm. Story catchers is a beautiful, yes, phrase. Mm-hmm. So this idea that, well, let's take a step back. I'm going to also give a shout out to a scholar named Arthur Frank. He's an amazing writer. He's known for a work called The Wounded Storyteller. So probably a lot of your listeners are going to be, mm-hmm, the echo there of Andre Nouwen's book, The Wounded Healer.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So powerful. And so Dr. Frank's book is called The Wounded Storyteller. And I first encountered it in my clinical work at Baylor. And in that book, he uses this phrase that is so useful to me. So when a person finds themselves a patient in a hospital, and maybe they've discovered that they have an illness and that news is a surprise, or maybe they have had a baby that they thought was going to be healthy and isn't, or maybe somebody cut them off in traffic and they have had a really acute trauma to their own body, Dr. Frank would say that person is experiencing narrative wreckage. Narrative wreckage, this indication that, isn't it a great phrase? Like you can, I know you can hear what it means, right?
It's hitting me like that phrase, narrative wreckage. And I want to come back and I want to let you continue, but I wanted to also just kind of, if you've, for many of our listeners, if you've ever been in a hospital as a patient, there is a narrative going on in your mind when you're in that setting. If you've had to be in a hospital for any length of time, because I went through that several years ago with some back issues that I had. But yeah, to your point, there is a narrative going on in the mind, in the brain of the patient. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We could even say something like, illness is an embodied narrative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our body enters this story that maybe is a cultural story or is a family story. And there's all these different kinds of narratives that are flying around in a hospital setting. You know what was going through your mind. You feel it somatically when you are wondering, can anybody address this problem that I'm having with my spinal column? Mm-hmm. Right? It's frightening. It initiates all kinds of disorientation.
Yeah.
One of the sources of that feeling of being disoriented is that the story we've been living is now in ruins. That's what Arthur Frank means by narrative wreckage. So maybe I enter the hospital, I'm in labor. I've never had a baby. I'm just vamping. But I think that this child is in a cultural and medical way going to be born healthy. Mm-hmm. And maybe something goes wrong during delivery. And now the story that I was living in and projecting myself into the future in is in ruins. Or we think we're on our way to work, but we have that traffic accident and our legs never walk again. We're in narrative wreckage. So it's not just physical experience of change. It's also this destruction of imagination and of sort of a home for meaning in our life. That home for meaning has been blown to bits by a narrative hurricane. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now we don't know where we are. We're not protected by narrative. We don't know who we are as a character in our own story anymore.
This is
one of the reasons that chaplains in hospitals need to be story catchers, is that the storytellers, the patients, need somebody who can honor this narrative wreckage and collect up all the precious little pieces that are left over after this narrative storm has gone through, and treat them with dignity and respect and honor them as the treasures that they are. Just like, so, you know, as you and I are recording this, Tristan, Hurricane Idalia has just gone through Florida, right?
Yes. And
we're praying for our countrymen down there. We're praying for people who are doing all the things that have to happen to keep people safe after the storm. And so if you and I had gone down to help somebody sort through the remains of their home, and we found a baby picture.
Yes.
We would know this yes. has got to be kept. This has mm-hmm. got to immediately be dried out. It's got to be put in something that protects it, because we've found this thing that we know is precious in the wreckage. We, yes. you and I don't know who that baby is, but no. somebody is, right?
No. Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's this parallel going on in clinical chaplaincy and really in all forms of caregiving and pastoral caregiving. You know, yeah. I know you know this mm-hmm. as somebody who sits in the clinical mental health space, that so we collect up these pieces of narrative wreckage and we offer them back to the person who is blessing us with the gift of their story. And sometimes they can begin to make a new story out of it. I will give you one example of thousands of conversations. Let me just say, Tristan, before I tell a story, that sure. the sacredness of those exchanges when a patient makes the courageous choice to share with their caregiver maybe something that has never been spoken before, never been witnessed before, to go back to our conversation in episode one. Mm-hmm. It is such a holy space. And yes. I could not possibly be who I am now without the gifts of those stories that were given to me by so many, by yes. so many people. So
yes.
So here is a brief story. Mm. I was bedside with a woman who was experiencing chronic pain, and she was an admitted patient, and her physician team, her excellent and compassionate physician team, was working somewhat fruitlessly to discover the source of her chronic pain. And so I came alongside her and we were talking about how long she had had this debilitating pain and how it had spiked again recently. And this woman had such high trauma in her life that making meaning was impossible for her to do on her own. Trauma mm-hmm. was so disorganized and disoriented her ability even to think chronologically. I know you know that yep. is a way that our brains protect ourselves.
Absolutely.
From trauma. So mm-hmm. her brain is working like a normal brain experiencing trauma. I said, when was the first time you remember having this chronic pain? And she said, one of my children died by suicide.
Okay.
And we honored that moment and shed some tears. And I said, now this most recent spike of pain that started 18 months ago, do you remember what initiated that? And believe me, I had no idea where this story was going. This is not mm-hmm. based on any kind of...
You were just being present.
I'm just catching the wreckage.
You're catching the wreckage, right? You're
I'm
in the moment.
I'm just catching the story.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And she mm-hmm. said, you know, I hadn't thought about this before, but my stepchild had the very same thing happen. He attempted to take his own life. He did not die. But just like with my own child, I found him. And she had never had a space before where she could make meaning out of those two experiences. She could connect them, where she could say, I think my body is responding the same way to the same set of somatic stimuli, to the same kind of shocking grief. So that would be one example of how making room for her to sort out some of her narrative wreckage became meaningful in her process of care. One of the things I love about working on a hospital team is that the chaplain gets to integrate with other expert care providers. So she was then able to take that story that she had never been able to tell herself before to a psychiatrist who was on her start doing some of that really skillful work with the right provider on the team.
Yes.
And so those kinds of things are what narrative-oriented care might look like in an acute care hospital type space. And you can see how important it was for her to have an opportunity to make that meaning. And then, thank God, you know, we had this team of professionals.
That's right.
Who could then take that new set of meaning and help her move toward healing in multiple levels of personhood.
Yeah.
So that's how that might look in the acute care hospital space.
Yeah.
We're living this embodied story of illness. We are experiencing narrative wreckage, and the first way toward a new and healed iteration of narrative identity is to be heard by a skillful listener,
mm-hmm.
so that a new meaning can be made.
Yes. I want to, I think something that you said a couple seconds ago, I think was so important, because what you've done is I think that it's time for us to widen the net when it comes to the narrative catchers in our society, particularly when you mentioned being a part of a team, right? So yes. A chaplain is a part of that team. Nurses are a part of that team. Doctors are a part of that team, because they not only are treating, but they are witnesses,
yes,
to the suffering that is going on in people's lives, right? And so I remember a few years ago when I was going through my back issues. So for those of you that don't know, I have a condition called lumbar spinal stenosis. And so my doctor told me that, you know, you probably had it your entire life, but for whatever reason, it's starting to show up now at this point. And it was extremely painful. So we go through all the x-rays and stuff like that. My body's trying to compensate. I'm walking with a lean, all that kind of stuff. And I'm a bigger guy. So, you know, there's that, athletics, all that kind of stuff. But basically when my neurosurgeon looked at the x-ray, he said, oh, so what's happening is that you've got a part of your lower back that's basically crushing a nerve, and you have nerve damage. That's why it's so painful. So he said, what I've got to go in and do is I've got to remove that so that the nerve can heal, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going, you know, of course that's frightening within itself, because I've never had a major surgery like this. And so we get to the hospital and everything like that, and I'm nervous, but Nancy's there, everything is great. We got friends and stuff that show up. And so I go through the surgery, and I don't learn this until after. My wife has to tell me, because she's had a conversation with the nurses and stuff, the people who were there in the room. And she said, Nancy told me that the nurses told her that when the doctor opened me up, they said it was actually worse than what the x-ray had showed. And I was like, what? She said, yeah. So the doctor, when he was looking at it, the nerve damage was so much worse than what I think he originally thought. So he was able to do the surgery, but there was just some stuff that the x-ray didn't show.
Mm-hmm.
But the wreckage catchers, right? They were able to convey that, hey man, like it was, we did the surgery, but it was worse than what we had originally thought. So you coming in, like it was a situation where my doctor said, you know, so I said, well, can I do the surgery in January? He was like, no. If you don't get this done now, you could be paralyzed. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, we're scheduling this, you know, ASAP. So shout out, I want to give a shout out to, and if you haven't recognized this, if you are in chaplaincy, if you're a nurse, if you're a doctor, any level where you have the responsibility of human care, you are a wreckage carrier. You are a narrative catcher, and I just want to just say how grateful I am. So yeah, go ahead, Chaplain Eva.
I didn't know that story, Tristan. Mm-hmm. That is a frightening story.
Frightening.
And I celebrate the care, good care that you received.
Baylor, by the way, shout out to Baylor. Shout out to Baylor Medical Center. The staff, the nurses there, they were wonderful. And I like, if I have to go to a hospital, I want to go to Baylor.
So do I.
I want to go to Baylor.
So do I. It was such a shaping place for me. And to pick up where you just brought us, Tristan, I think every caregiving field, all of those medical disciplines that you just named, and then I want to fold into our colleagues who are in pastoral ministry.
Please, yes.
People who are working for churches and nonprofits. There is, I think, sometimes the sense that we don't have time or we don't get paid to listen to people tell their stories. Yes. Or that maybe when we've taken some time to do so, that we diminutize that as caregiving, that we, you know, I don't know what to say, but I'm just listening, or I'm not trained as a professional mental health person like Tristan is. So all I can do is listen. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is that where the empirical data stands is that when that kind of listening that honors the story, that doesn't move to fix, that can be a witness to suffering, when we can listen like that, there's no just listening. That listening is where the transformative meaning making happens.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter if that listener ever went to school a day in their lives. Doesn't matter if they are literate. It doesn't matter anything about their status in the world. Any person who's willing can learn to render the kind of listening to a person who needs to be heard in such a way that these incredibly redemptive and transformative things can come forward. So the research in narrative identity would indicate something like a person who is listened to with skill,
yes,
has the possibility to see redemptive themes in their story. This term, redemptive, is coming out of the psychological community. This is not a theological body of data.
Mm-hmm.
But that person, I know, that's part of why I love this. This is how we're all made.
Yeah.
A person who is heard with skill may begin to see redemptive themes in their story, and those redemptive themes in the data transfer into a desire to see other people flourish, service to the kind of people who need to be heard,
mm-hmm.
and generativity, a desire to see people who are not even born yet also have the opportunity to flourish. So anybody who is willing to be the kind of listener who will take the burden of story,
that's right,
who will collect up the narrative wreckage and make a meaning-making space, can be affecting the future for the teller of that story so dramatically. It blows my hair back when I think about what a willing listener can do. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And when we talk about the research background, there's in my work, when we talk about indicators of success in terms of the therapeutic relationship, right? And so you go, well, I think that we think coming in, we think that it's, you know, our theoretical orientation, we think that it's our education, all the degrees, you know, that kind of thing, whatever the case may be. But the success indicator is in our field is the therapeutic relationship. And part of that is just being able to listen. And one of the, I think a term that I picked up, oh, that's what it was. I was with Andy Thacker. Here's Andy Thacker again, right? In our normal human development class when I was coming through. And she talked about what we're creating as clinicians in the therapy moment is you're trying to help a person have a reparative experience. So you may not use the language of redemptive, but you most certainly are having or helping the person to have a reparative experience in that moment. When you talk about the listening piece, the attunement, just having somebody there who is actually listening to you. And I had a client this week where, you know, so we do genograms and stuff like that. So you're able to see what's going on throughout the generations. And what I realized was that this person is coming to me because of an inability to be able to connect emotionally. So they disconnect physically to protect themselves, stuff like that. And so what was happening in the family system was there had been a history of trauma that was unprocessed, right? Yes. And so parents, you pass that way of dealing with stuff onto your kids, on the subsequent generations, so that when they start functioning in their relationships, they start doing the same thing. But what I realized as we started doing the genogram was, oh, you're actually breaking this cycle. You're breaking the pattern. Like, so this is gonna stop with you.
Yes.
And so that's part of the reparative experience is being able to get into therapy yourself, take your system, and then your kids are able to see, oh, well, mom and dad go to therapy. So mm-hmm. you go, okay, so if I have issues or problems, then I don't have to be an island.
Yes.
Or I don't have to rely on these unhelpful maladaptive coping mechanisms. There are healthy ways to deal with the issues in my life.
I love that. If in my world, I'm not safe for that client who had the blessing of you as her reparative partner, if she has moved into a new narrative identity.
Yes. She's
now the person who can break the cycle.
That's
she's
good.
The person who can get help without shame.
Mm-hmm.
The person who's not going to pass this on to the next generation.
Yes.
She's the person who can honor her own trauma. Like all of those stories that might be active in her having carried for her lifetime unprocessed trauma,
mm-hmm.
and both have a group of stories attached to them. She,
mm-hmm.
because she's had this reparative, this corrective experience with you,
right? Exactly.
She can then,
yeah,
occupy and celebrate a new narrative identity in herself.
Absolutely. And it was, I was thinking the same thing with you, with the example that you gave, in the hospital when you were with the woman. You were like, you created the space for her to have a redemptive experience, a reparative experience in that moment. So you talked about the narrative aspect from your time in the hospitals. How have you seen it with your students in the classroom and relationships that you've had there?
Goodness. You know, I think before I give an example from my students, I will mm-hmm. just say,
yeah,
I think I had reparative experiences with Dr. Sandra Glant, with Dr. Scott Harrell, and to name another friend that we have in common, with Chaplain Bill Bryan. The way that I hope to make space for my students is based on the way that those professors made space for me when I wasn't in seminary. And it gives me imagination for the crushing weight of secret that somebody who might look very organized on the surface might be with her or him into their theological education.
Absolutely.
So some of the ways that I'm seeing this really active in my students right now, so many of them are moving toward vocational ministry because they have already experienced church hurt.
Yes.
They have already had disillusioning or painful or worse, you know, abusive or unethical experiences in the house of the Lord. And I am so delighted to see how my students who are learning the philosophy and theology and skills of pastoral care, they want to do it differently. Just like you described this possibility that rises up in your client
when she
moves toward her own need. These students that are coming into my classroom are ready to do things in a different way. They are determined not to perpetuate the problems that they have already experienced in their experience of the sort of, I guess, the organized Protestant church in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we try to do a lot of story work together in the regular classroom, in the clinical training portion for pastoral care and chaplaincy. That is a highly narrative oriented endeavor. You know, it's just amazing what comes up in us when we go through an adaptive phase, like we're moving from being a student who goes to the library and writes papers to being a student who is now going to a code blue in the emergency room.
Right.
Boy, do we find out some things.
You're talking about night and day.
I know. It's really rigorous, but that's where the transformation happens in that experience of disorientation. Like, I don't know who I am, and I don't know what my goal is. And in all of these frameworks that we're touching, that's the place where regenerative and redemptive meaning really can take hold.
Yes.
Because we're not operating unconsciously anymore. All of a sudden, we are aware. It's like we wake up and realize something new is happening in me, and it's really scary.
Yep.
But I'm going to trust the process of God and move toward this new thing that's happening in my life. So I see that happening in the academic classroom and in training with my students. I wish we could bring some of them into the podcast. Their stories of just confronting all kinds of things that they've been telling themselves for life. Like, I'm stupid. I'm not as good as a student as every single other person in this room. Mm-hmm. Confronting a story that a student might be telling themselves like that, or I can't do what someone else is doing because of my gender, or I am never going to be brave enough to do what God is asking me to do. All these things come alive. And once they're lit up and we can bring them into the learning space, the really cool thing that happens is when the other students in the classroom provide the corrective and redemptive experience. Doesn't even have to be the professor. They see in each other. They act as community. They take on and discount lies for each other.
Yeah.
And they lift up one another's most holy and God-given traits. It's amazing. I can't believe that's my job.
Chaplain Eva, I'm I want to say I'm grateful for you bringing up the fact that the reason why you are able to do what you do is because of your own redemptive, reparative experiences in your life. And I kind of want to take that and speak to the seminary students out there, those who are in ministry training, pastoral care, different things like that, because this is a particular soapbox of mine, because it is crucial that if you are seeking to be an agent of change, a witness of suffering in people's lives, we talk about being on the front lines of human care, and I challenge seminaries and places of ministry to do this, is don't you dare send people out into the world to do this work, and you have not created or provided a platform for them to be able to do that work in their lives. And so one of the things that we had to go through in our training was we had to actually do 20 sessions of counseling ourselves, right? And so it's like, and so I think that it's going to be critical, particularly for pastors who are on the front lines of people's lives as well. Like, if they're going to provide healing, like they're going to have to be in the process themselves. And so it's one of those things where kind of the way we think about it is as therapists, is to be able to say, you know, I don't know how much I could trust a therapist who hasn't been through therapy himself or herself. You know what I mean? So that's kind of, Absolutely. So I appreciate you sharing your own personal transformation before you try to go to other people.
I love what you're saying, Tristan, and I pray for the day that we are where it is abnormal and unusual to see a person in Christian leadership perpetuate the harm that maybe they have received in their own story.
Absolutely.
I hope that day is coming soon. I think if I were to follow your example and just speak directly to someone who might be listening, I might say that what I discovered as a seminarian and in my training period for chaplaincy is that I didn't anticipate how God would want to love me during that time. I anticipated needing to demonstrate that I was smart. I anticipated needing to become professional in my skill-giving capacity. But I did not put myself in the center of any of that learning. And what I found was that not only did God determine to love me by leading me through painful transformation, He loved me more than I wanted to be loved. I didn't want to get real about the places where my story was broken. I didn't want to get real about my family of origin. I wanted to keep those things secret even from myself. And the Lord loved me enough to bring those things into the light. So that is, I like you, I hope for a vision of preparation for ministry that accounts for the whole personhood and preparation through the whole person, and not merely intellectual and skill-based prep. I did experience that with just professors who let me talk and were not afraid of what I might say. And then I did a lot of therapy too. Yeah, right? And we all need it. I don't trust a person who doesn't need therapy sometimes.
Can't trust you. So I want to talk a little bit about your background in the academy, because that's actually an area that I'm very curious about, that I don't I don't know how you came to that. So how did you come to teaching in the academy, and what has that been like for you, Chaplain Emo?
That's such a kind question. So Josh and I were living out in, nope, that's not the right start. The right start is when I was at Baylor University Medical Center and I was closing out my residency in pastoral care. I wrote a self-evaluation, and part of the self-evaluation was to give some reflective attention to my hopes for the future, my vocational hopes. And I remember writing, I hope that someday I can have one foot in a classroom and one foot in the clinic. Mm-hmm. So even in the richest part of my hospital-based training, I was imagining that maybe there might be a teaching role of some sort. I didn't know what.
Mm-hmm.
I did not imagine myself ever being a seminary professor. So we left, Josh and I left Dallas. We spent 5 years on the East Coast, really important season for us. And I was working as a hospital chaplain. Boy, there's a lot I could say about learning from that situation too. I was so stalled out in my career. I felt like I had been educated to a point where I was not even useful to anyone. I didn't know how to obey the Lord because I didn't know what he was asking of me. It was extremely hard. And it was maybe a milder version of narrative wreckage than we were talking about before, where mm-hmm. when I looked at my story, the pieces didn't make any sense. Like I had felt like I was on a trajectory professionally and with my education, and instead nothing was happening. And in the midst of that, I got a call from Denver Seminary. Denver called me. And it's so unusual, Tristan, for that to be the story behind moving into the academy. I know that it is not unusual for many people, even hundreds of people, to apply for the same job in higher ed. Higher ed sure. is having a tough time right now.
Absolutely.
So it felt like God was finally giving me some direction in a season where I just was so discouraged. So that is, I'll give a couple more names here. A long-term colleague of mine, Chaplain Cindy Simpson, who I knew from my days in Texas, and Dr. Jan McCormack, who pioneered the chaplaincy program at Denver Seminary. The two of them reached out to me and invited me to come and join them in the academic space here. And it was a yes for me. So I had already been looking around at maybe, Lord, do you want me to do a terminal degree of some sort? And I had received some no's from schools that seemed like they were the perfect fit. So I was entering my terminal degree at Baylor University right at the time that Denver Seminary called me. And so I'm sitting at a place right now that I think is such a small portion of our lives, but at this existential moment, the big pieces of my story make sense to me. And I'm thankful to be at that point after a lot of years of not feeling like that, and where a normal day was a dysregulated day or a disappointing day where the narrative I was telling myself was pretty dark. I am grateful, and I think I would just say to you as my friend and brother, and to the people who care about this podcast, who are trusting you as their guide, in this podcast that God's love is real for you in this moment, whatever else may be true at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you for that, Chaplain Eva. I want to, as we're kind of landing the plane here a little bit. I'm having so much fun, but
I know.
we gotta land the plane. But what's been the best piece of advice you've received as an academic?
Don't tell yourself no.
Don't tell yourself no. Okay.
Don't tell yourself no. There's enough people invested in telling me no in the world. So
tell yourself no. Okay.
Tell yourself no. So if you think, I want to apply to this school, but I don't think I can get in, you know, let them tell you no. Mm-hmm. Don't tell yourself no. Go ahead and apply.
Okay.
If you think, I'm looking at this job on Indeed, and I only have 3 of the 4 qualifications that are listed in this job description. Don't tell yourself no. Let them tell you no. Go ahead and apply. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best piece of advice, is letting the process play out. We can learn even from the things that are not our path, but making it an instinct and an automatic reflex to at least give ourselves a chance in the academic space and in the workplace space. I think that's the best advice that I've ever received.
Yep. Okay. So the last couple of questions, they're my rapid fire questions. So I'm going to ask you these, and then we'll get out of here. The first question is, what did you want to be growing up?
A giraffe.
You wanted to be a giraffe.
How old am I when you're asking this question, Tristan? I think I really wanted to be a veterinarian. I love
to be a vet.
Animals.
Okay.
I started pre-med, pre-vet when I was in college, and I hit some obstacles with regard to mathematics.
Okay.
And that changed my path, but I my whole life I have loved all creatures, great and small.
So, like I said, all behavior makes sense in context. So you don't take care of animals right now. I'm sure you're still a lover of animals.
Oh yeah.
But you take care of people. So that makes perfect sense. So what is your most favorite meal ever of all time?
Of all time.
Your favorite meal.
Okay, I love food so much, it's shameful, but because
it's not Chaplain Eva. You love food, like you were made to love it.
I love food, and so what's coming to my mind right this minute is walking from Dallas Seminary to La Banqueta with Jamie Hightower and Ryan Holmes. And eating real Mexican food out of tinfoil, and just having these explosions of flavor in my mouth.
Yes.
That's my answer for right now.
Yes. You know what? I love it because you painted a picture, right? And you didn't put like a food on it. You just said it's wrapped in tinfoil.
Like if it's running down my arm,
that's a good and so Nancy and I love that spot as well, and so we're probably going to get some next week now that you mentioned it. So when you come back to Texas, is that a place that you and Josh, like, y'all have to go?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also love Bangkok City Thai right there in the
That's our other favorite. That's our second favorite on Bryan Street. It's wonderful.
Do a little food ball.
I don't know if you're familiar with Chicago at all. That's where I'm from. But we have a Portillo's. We have a Portillo's down here now. And I'm like, we've got to get to Portillo's at some point. So,
and what are you going to get there?
Definitely we have to get a hot dog. We have to get a few of those. I don't know if I'm as familiar with their burgers, but I'm pretty sure they're good too. And I think they have milkshakes as well. But I haven't had anything from Portillo's in years. So we want to get there as soon as possible. Chaplain Eva, thank you so much for hanging out on the Real Humans podcast. If our audience wants to connect with you, how do they do that?
EvaBleeker.com.
EvaBleeker.com. Okay, and I'll put it in the show notes as well. Hey, thank you so much. I'll see you next time.
Thanks, Tristan.
Yep.